numbers 76024, the State of Nevada Board of Parole Commissioners versus the Second Judicial District Court, and the real party in interest, Marlon Thompson. So we have Ms. Brady representing the appellant here, the appellant, and there's the petitioner here. Excuse me for saying, the petitioner. Sorry, I got the right statement here. On behalf of the respondent is Ms. Haar, and Ms. Kate is here on behalf of the amicus curiae. The timing on this is how we're going to do this a little bit different, and we went through it with the court clerk, so hopefully I have it right here, but we'll have each side, the regular has 15 minutes. Ms. Brady, you can reserve some of your 15 minutes if you would like as rebuttal, so we'll hear from you first. We'll hear from Ms. Kate, then on behalf of the Washoe County District Attorney's Office, second for her time, and then we'll hear from the real party in interest, and again, if you reserve any time, Ms. Brady, you'll have some time left for rebuttal. Okay, I hope that's clear, but we'll go ahead and we'll start with Ms. Brady representing the Nevada Board of Parole Commissioners. And again, Justice Silver is not present today, but she will be listening to this tape and participating in the decision of this case.
Great, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Kathleen Brady. I'm here on behalf of the Nevada Board of Parole Commissioners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The Parole Board brings this petition to address an inconsistency that has arisen in Nevada law. District courts have made differing rulings as to whether life sentences imposed before the 1995 modification of Nevada sentencing statutes to provide for minimum and maximum terms of incarceration may be modified pursuant to NRS 176033. The Parole Board asks this court to resolve this issue and determine that life sentences imposed before Nevada sentencing statutes were amended in 1995 may be modified pursuant to NRS 176.033. This court should entertain this group petition because it raises an important issue of law that requires clarification regarding sentence structures. And it's in the interest of public policy and sound judicial administration to have consistent rulings across the state on this issue. And because the parole board is not a party to the underlying criminal proceeding, it doesn't have an available remedy in the form of an appeal. The district court argues that the parole board lacks standing to bring this case because it doesn't have a direct beneficial interest in permitting the modification of life sentences. However, the parole board has the requisite direct and substantial interest that's within the protected zone of interest. The district court says that the parole board's only explicit duties are to establish parole standards and render decisions. However, this ignores the statute on point, NRS 176033, which the legislature has charged the parole board with using. The parole board has an interest in litigating questions involving its statutory duties, and it has a direct interest in using the statutory grant in the manner intended by the legislature and consistently across the jurisdictions of the state. Right now, this is not happening, and the parole board would directly benefit from knowing how it should apply its law and would suffer a detriment if not given guidance as to how to fairly apply the statute. Right now, the parole board is holding off on filing 6 petitions in district courts across the state in hopes that this court will issue a decision that clarifies the inconsistency in Nevada law. So the writ should issue in this case to correct the district court's erroneous interpretation of Nevada law. In the underlying criminal case, Mr. Thompson was convicted in 1979 of first-degree murder. At the time of his conviction, the 1977 version of NRS 176033 was in effect. And at that time, it provided in pertinent part that the court may modify an original sentence by reducing the term of imprisonment, but shall not make the term less than the minimum limit prescribed by the applicable penal statute. While this section of the statute was again amended in 1995 to change the language from minimum limit to minimum term, the legislature provided that those amendments do not apply retroactively It explicitly declared that those amendments do not apply to offenses which were committed before July 1st, 1995. The statutory change only applied prospectively because it altered the way that criminal defendants were sentenced in this state and for the first time required felony convictions to include minimum and maximum sentences of imprisonment. At the time of Mr. Thompson's conviction, there were no minimum and maximum terms of imprisonment required in the criminal statutes. Accordingly, the minimum limit and not the minimum phrase term applies to this case and makes it clear that individuals such as Mr. Thompson, who were sentenced to life sentences, were and are eligible under the statute for modifications of their life sentences. I wanted to clear up some confusion at this point. The amicus provides that the parole board's position appears to be that the current version of NRS 176-033 does not apply, and that instead the 1977 version of the statute applies. However, it's the parole board's position that the statute is being applied prospectively, and that the amendments all apply except for the 1995 amendments, which specifically indicate that they don't apply. So the 1977 language concerning minimum and maximum limits and the 1987 clarification to the statute that provided that half of life was 10 years for those serving life sentences, both apply. And when the statute is read as a whole, it's clear that individuals serving life sentences, such as Mr. Thompson, are eligible for relief. The applicable sentencing statute that was in effect at the time of his conviction provided that Mr. Thompson could have been punished by life with or without the possibility of parole, with parole eligibility beginning after 10 years had been served. Thus, the minimum limit in this case is 10 years. In this regard, the district court argues that the plain language of NRS 176-033, subsection 1, indicates that penal statutes set forth either minimum and maximum limits or just maximum limits. And it argues that the pertinent legal penal statute allowed for two sentences, life with or without the possibility of parole, that both only had the maximum limit of life. The district court argues that parole eligibility cannot be considered the minimum limit because the court could not have sentenced Mr. Thompson to only a term of 10 years of imprisonment. However, it's the minimum limit and not the minimum term section or language in the statute that applies in this case.
But why would the sentence about the minimum limit need to be in the statute then? Because you can only have been on parole for the required period of time if you reached your parole eligibility and actually were paroled. So wouldn't that make it superfluous or unneeded to say that?
So in the case of life sentences, I think it is superfluous because the minimum limit is when you're parole eligible. I believe that it was incorporated in the statutes in 1973 when non-felony convictions did have sentences that didn't have necessarily parole eligibility but had, say, 5 to 10 years. And so the person was convicted of a 5 to 10 year sentence, but their parole eligibility could become, they could become parole eligible before the 5 years is up. And so I think that's what the last language or the last sentence of the statute was meant to convey.
So in other words, if they were had a crime where they were getting time off their front end, it might come into play.
Right, exactly. But with life sentences, you either get a life with or without parole. You don't. There is no, or there is now, but back then there was no 10 to life sentence. So as is evidenced in this case, there's three different counsel that are looking at this issue, and there's three different interpretations of the statute. And I think those arguments that have been made before this court make it clear that there are multiple interpretations of what the term minimum limit actually means in the statute. And it's indeed ambiguous. And when the statute's ambiguous, this court looks to the legislative history, which makes it clear that the parole board's interpretation of the statute is correct. The parole board's interpretation is harmonious with the legislative history of the 1987 statutory amendments that make it clear that the statute's applies to persons subject to life sentences. In 1987, the statute was amended to provide that individuals serving life sentences are eligible for modification under the statute after 10 years on parole. The bill did not have an effective date. However, it was introduced in the form of a question whether it was purposeful on the legislature's part to exclude life sentences from the possibility of sentence modifications, or whether or not it was just an oversight at the time the legislation was passed. And the testimony provided that it was an oversight. If it was an oversight, then the recommendation was that half of life be considered 10 years on parole.
Do we know anything about when the testimony was presented and they cited a certain number of then existing parolees that were eligible or would soon be if this was adopted? Do we know whether any of them were on parole for crimes where life was the only available sentence?
That is not in the record, Your Honor.
Right.
I do not know that, but I do know that those individuals, so the legislative history mentions that there were 11 individuals that were going to become eligible under the statute if the amendment was adopted, which it was adopted.
Because, for example, like for second-degree murder, life was an available sentence, but there were also available, like, you know, anything up from 5 years or something, 5 years up to life could be imposed.
So at the time that the 1987 amendments were made, there were alternative sentences. Individuals subject to such a second-degree murder where life wasn't always the only option, it was either a determinate sentence or it was a life sentence with or without the possibility of parole. So those are two separate sentences. And in the legislative history, it indicates that the people who are going to be eligible were serving life sentences. And so those people had been sentenced to life. They hadn't been sentenced to a determinate period of time.
And sorry, before your time's up, I just wanted to ask, it's my understanding there may be a recent change to this statute from the legislature. How, if at all, does that affect this case?
That is correct, Your Honor. Actually, exactly 1 year to the date, this section of the statute will no longer be applicable. It will be removed by the ACAJ bill, AB 236.
Okay.
However, there is 1 year where the parole board can still use this statute, and it does have people that it's waiting to use it for.
Well, and as to that statute, it doesn't become effective on this provision until July 1, 2020, so it's a year off.
Right.
And there's nothing in the statute that indicates that elimination of subsection 2 is intended to be retroactive, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Can I ask you one question before you move on? I guess what causes me a little pause is if the 1977 version applies, how do you measure whether or not you've served one half of a life sentence?
So my argument is that the 1987 amendment that makes it clear that half of life is 10 years would also apply in this case. Because this is a remedial prospective statute that's applied at the time the individual actually meets the requirements for the parole board to petition the court, my argument would be that unless expressly declared not to apply retroactively, the laws would apply. And those only the 1995 amendments wouldn't apply.
Okay.
And that's because they explicitly said so?
Yes, Your Honor. And I just wanted to make one more point very quickly. The parole board's interpretation of the statute wouldn't render any language nugatory. If you accept the district court or amicus's position, it would render the 1987 amendments to be meaningless. Because at the time of the 1987 amendments, the crimes that carried life sentences only carried life sentences with or without the possibility of parole. There were no 10 to life sentences at that time for the life sentence statutes. Thus, if you read the statute in the manner provided by the district court or amicus, the 1987 amendment that added that sentence to allow for people serving life sentences to petition the court, or petition the board to petition the court, would be meaningless. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. And Ms. Bray, you have about a minute 43 in rebuttal at the end of everybody else speaking then.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think Ms. Kate would go next. That's to give counsel an opportunity to hear from both sides before you have to respond or anything like that. So we'll hear from the Washoe County District Attorney's Office.
May it please the Court, my name is Marilee Kate. I represent the Washoe County District Attorney's Office in this case. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm going to jump right in. One question that came up, I believe, Justice Kadish, you asked about the 1995 amendments to 176.033, and I pulled that up. It's in Section 30, and the 1995 amendments don't, with respect to Section with respect to the statute at issue, only corrected a technical issue about the time it went into effect. And so if you look at that in the legislative history, I think the petition of the parole board is taking the position of the entire bill, which was quite lengthy, I have it right here, like the current AB 236, was to correct a number of criminal justice statutes, not just this one. And so this one was specific to correct a technical time frame issue. And so I think that's important. But one thing that is difficult about the parole board's position, and it's come up in a couple questions, is that they've taken an inconsistent position with respect to what version of the statute actually applies, what version of 176.033 applies. And he, in this case, the parole board saying, well, we want certain language from 1987. We want certain language from 1977 and not the current form. But when the parole board petitioned this court to consider this case, it cited to a district court case where the district court allegedly took a different position than the district court in our underlying case. And at page 146 in the appendix, you can see that in that order, which was submitted by counsel in the underlying Clark County case, the current version of 176.033 was used. The full language of that. And so now, because the parole board wants to apply different terminology, minimum limit versus minimum term, the parole board is trying to piecemeal together what version applies. But really, it is the current version. And when you look at it, that version is very clear. It talks about what the minimum term is. And I will say, even if you apply minimum limit, I think the Washoe County District Attorney's Office position is the same. If you look at the murder statute from 1977, the version that applied to Mr. Thompson's sentence, it is very clear that the only available sentences in this case are life with the possibility of parole and life without the possibility of parole. There's two, and the first sentence is very important. Every person convicted of murder of the first degree shall be punished by imprisonment in the state of, in state prison for life with or without the possibility of parole. The second sentence addresses parole eligibility if you are given life with the possibility of parole.
So what's the point of going to the trouble of explicitly changing the statute to say, for a life sentence, after 10 years on parole, you're eligible for this potential remedy?
So that section was actually changed in 1987. That language was added. At that time, still the language about minimum limit was still in the statute. But subsequent to that, our legislature has further limited NRS 176.033 and added the language in the last sentence that says, the court may modify the original sentence by reducing the maximum term of imprisonment, but shall not make the term less than the minimum term prescribed by the applicable penal statute. So since that time, the legislature has actually limited the application again. So I certainly can see that in 1987, the legislature did at least include language that arguably would address Mr. Thompson's position. However, the current version, the legislature has been very clear that it does not apply. They say they look at the maximum term of imprisonment, minimum term of imprisonment, and the applicable penal statute, and there it is life with or without the possibility of parole. This court and other opinions have said parole is a privilege. It's not a right. Justice Stiglitz said that in a recent opinion in Anselmo v. Bisbee. To adopt the parole board's position that 10 years on the sentence, this parole at 10 years, is the minimum limit would essentially be adopting the position that you're entitled almost to parole or entitled to.
Ms. Cates, you're not entitled necessarily to parole, but you're entitled to consideration for parole. I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
Well, but see, in this position, Mr. Thompson isn't the one petitioning the court. It's the parole board. And he certainly is entitled. May I finish my thought?
Yes.
He certainly is entitled, I believe under that Anselmo opinion that you authored, to consideration for parole. The state and the Washoe County District Attorney's Office isn't saying that this court should adopt any different position from that. The point, though, is the parole board's ability to petition and what the parole board and the jurisdictional essential limit of the district court to consider this modification of a sentence. And so in that respect, it's limited to reducing his maximum term.
So if Mr. Thompson was petitioning, you'd agree that he would be entitled to relief? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Who the petitioner is decides this outcome?
No, I think...
Is that what you said?
No, I apologize if that is how it came off. What I mean is that if Mr. Thompson can apply to the parole board, and did, he is on parole, right? He doesn't, under the statute, 176.033, have the right to petition the court to change, modify a sentence. The ability of a district court, after a judgment's entered, to modify a sentence is very limited. And the legislature has provided the district court a limited ability to modify a sentence based on a petition of the parole board that we're talking about to modify. So Mr. Thompson can certainly seek a pardon or seek parole the same way he always has, and he's entitled to do that. But the petitioner, in this case, the parole board, is limited to what types of petitions they can bring. The district court is limited to what they can hear. And the district court correctly concluded that it could consider petitions of the parole board, but that it wasn't appropriate in this case based on Mr. Thompson's sentence at the time he was actually sentenced in the language of the statute at that time. And so the Washoe County District Attorney's Office would just ask that you deny and decline to issue the writ petition in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Kate. Okay, Ms. Haar, we'll hear from you now, and you'll have your full 15 minutes.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Teresa Haar on behalf of respondents, the Second Judicial District Court, and Judge Steinheimer. We request that the writ be denied. The first thing you heard from
Ms. Haar, I apologize. I know you haven't even gotten a word out yet, but I have a procedural question.
Yes.
You're from the State Attorney General's office, correct?
Yes.
And so is your colleague for the petitioner in this case, right?
Yes.
And what steps are there to avoid there being a conflict between the two of you?
Judge Steinheimer, she cleared any potential conflicts. A wall has been set up. Myself and Ms. Brady, while we've been on the same side of many cases before, we've been completely walled off from each other in terms of preparation and mooting these arguments. We had a completely separate group of individuals, so all necessary walls have been done, and we've had authorization from my client that there's no conflict here.
All right, thank you. Proceed.
The first thing you heard from the board in their argument today was that this is a matter of great public importance, and that's why we need a writ. And generally, questions involving statutory interpretation of sentencing parameters would be of great public importance. But here, it is such a limited application that's at issue. We have a question of, does this statute apply for someone who has been convicted of first-degree murder prior to 1995, who has already been placed on parole, who has done at least 10 consecutive years on parole? Parole and probation has made the recommendation that they are suitable to be released. The Board of Parole Commissioners has made the determination that they are eligible to have a reduction in their sentence, and then it's petitioned to the court. And we only have 1 year left for these to apply. And so it's such an incredibly limited issue. And while Ms. Brady said that there's others that they're thinking about applying this to, there's nothing in the record to indicate that this actually applies to anyone but Mr. Thompson. And so for that reason alone, it is such a narrow issue, a writ should not issue. As a secondary matter, The board claims that because it doesn't have a plain, speedy, and adequate remedy at law, a writ should issue. But here, while the board is who petitions the district court for a reduction in the sentence, the party that benefits is actually Mr. Thompson. And if we look at this holistically, this is one step in terms of exhaustion for an individual to apply for a pardon. So we go through all of those steps first. Once the parole board makes the recommendation to the district court, it is only if the district court denies the request for reduction in a sentence that an individual is then eligible to apply for a pardon. So this is really a lot more of an exhaustion of remedies step. And that's why the parole board does not have standing here and actually does not. We don't need to consider whether they have a speedy, adequate, and remedy at law. It's whether Mr. Thompson does. And the pardon being the next step for his application is his remedy.
So if the history repeats itself in front of the pardons board, we might see Mr. Thompson in the next century.
Well, as you are all aware, as the members of the pardons board, if you are compelled by Mr. Thompson's good behavior and him being an upstanding member of the community, any one of you could easily make the recommendation that his application be placed onto the agenda to be considered.
I wish that were true.
Ms. Saar, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Apart from that question, though, did I understand when you began that you represent Mr. Thompson as well as the court?
No.
Okay.
Only Judge Steinheiner in the Second Judicial District.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. So Mr. Thompson's interests here are unrepresented.
That's correct. He did file his own separate appeal. It was denied as being untimely, but he did have that remedy and that avenue to pursue. It was just he did not file it in a timely manner.
So what's your position about the fact that the language in 1987 says if you've served 10 consecutive years, you're eligible under this statute?
That is.
Are you saying that that just doesn't apply to him?
That does not apply to him because that applies to individuals that were sentenced to a life sentence, but the crime they were convicted of is something less
than life. So this gets to a broader question. Why doesn't this statute come into play when the person who's eligible for it reaches or achieves the requirements specified in the statute? Why would this statute be assessed at the time of his sentencing? I mean, at the time that the parole board seeks relief or a change in his sentence, rather than the time of his original sentencing?
Because it's not retroactive, and so you have to look at what was in place at the time.
I don't think retroactivity comes into play. The statute's provisions say they don't even apply until you've achieved certain minimum requirements. So when you've achieved those, wouldn't the statute then come into play and we read the statute as it exists at the time?
Even reading the statute that way, it still says you cannot reduce the sentence beyond the minimum. And so,
but isn't that in conflict with the provisions that were added regarding 10 years of parole in 1987?
I don't believe so because parole eligibility is separate from the minimum sentence. And so,
but isn't that an alternative way by which a person who is placed on parole can seek this relief?
Well, I think that if we look at, for example, the three examples that the board provided that they're claiming are inconsistent applications, two of them were sentenced to second-degree murder, which has a minimum less than life, and the third was convicted as a habitual criminal, which has a minimum of 25 years in the alternative.
I'd like to stick with Mr. Thompson's case. What about him? Isn't he eligible? Isn't he a person who has served 10 years on parole, more than 10 years on parole?
He has served more than 10 years on parole. However, it cannot be reduced below the minimum, which was a life sentence. And so if we look at Pinata versus State, this court back in 1960 said very clearly, setting sentences for felonies is the exclusive jurisdiction and power of the legislature. The legislature determined your only two options for a sentence for first-degree murder are life with or without the possibility of parole.
So what cases would the 10-year parole, having served 10 years of parole, what cases would that apply to?
So if you are sentenced, for example, second-degree murder, and you have your minimum sentence under the statute is at least 5 years, the maximum is life with the possibility of parole. So you have an individual that was sentenced to life, for second-degree murder, as long as they've completed more than the minimum under which this the crime that they were convicted of. That's where you get into the serving 10 years on parole for a life sentence. There has to be a minimum sentence, though, for the crime that they were convicted of for this to apply. But here, for first-degree murder, your options are life with or without the possibility of parole. There is no deviating below a life sentence.
In 1987, when the change was made to allow after 10 years on parole for someone serving a life sentence, were there crimes at that time that carried potential life sentences and less than life sentences?
So at that time...
Because I thought your colleague across the aisle over there told us there weren't. So I'm trying to understand what the legislature thought they were doing in 1987.
I believe that second degree murder still had a less than life availability.
Okay.
And I also believe that sexual assault causing substantial bodily harm for a victim under the age of 16 also was a maximum of life and a minimum of something less than life, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Okay. Thank you.
But Ms. Hoare, they specifically in 1987 address a prisoner sentenced to life imprisonment. So they address exactly the issue here. And so I'm not sure I understand why that doesn't apply.
So there's a distinction between, you have to look at not only what they were sentenced to, so if they were sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, but all available sentences.
It doesn't say that here. It says, or in the case of a prisoner sentenced to life imprisonment. Why do I have to read all these other things in? Why isn't 1987 just efforts to expand this to a prisoner who's sentenced to life so we don't have the conundrum of what is a half of a life? Why?
There's a couple things here. Firstly, because the statute says that the sentence cannot be reduced below the minimum. And I don't think the parole eligibility, I have not found a single case that says parole eligibility or actually being released on parole is a minimum. Because parole, you're still serving your term of imprisonment. You are just no longer serving it while incarcerated. And so I think it's important to note that your term of imprisonment isn't just served while incarcerated. And so I think that's a very important distinction. But we also just have to look at, this is essentially allowing the board with the benefit of hindsight to make sentencing recommendations. And so all the sentences still have to fall within the available sentence for the crime they were convicted of. And I don't think that you can, I don't think we're reading too much into that because you can't get around the fact that there are only certain sentences available for certain crimes. And first degree murder, the only available sentence is life with or without the possibility of parole.
So if you were sentenced for, I mean, I know that it's changed a lot over the years, but if you had a crime that carries, like a robbery that's a 2 to 15 year sentence, the minimum possible sentence is 2 to 5 years, which is actually 5 years with parole eligibility after 2 years. So are you saying under this last sentence of the statute that even if they got paroled at 2 years and served half of that time, they would need to be, the full sentence would have to be at least 5 years?
That's my interpretation of it, yes. Okay. You still have to complete parole through the minimum term of incarceration, or the minimum term of imprisonment, I'm sorry. And so,
right, which even though we talk about 2 to 15 is actually 5.
Yes.
Because the minimum available sentence would be 5 years with parole eligibility after 2.
That's my interpretation, yes.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Brady, you have a little under 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Chief Justice. So the district attorney's office has provided that the parole board in this case has taken an inconsistent opinion and cites the Lyons case that was provided in the appendix. I would just like to note that at the time that the petitions were filed in these cases, the parole board actually was the entity that was filing the petitions, and the Lyons case did not get briefed. When the parole board filed the petition, they were using the current version of the statute, which is why the current version of NRS 176.033 was used in the Lyons decision. I don't believe that's taking an inconsistent position. I just believe that was a result of there not being briefing in the Lyons case addressing this issue because it was not raised in that case by the district court. I also wanted to address both the DA and the district court's arguments that Mr. Thompson can go ahead and seek a pardon. And while he definitely has this right, that does not help the parole board clarify how it needs to be applying the statute. And it really does not want to be applying the statute inconsistently across the state, knowing that if it petitions in certain courts, it'll get granted, and if it gets petitioned in other courts, it won't. It doesn't feel comfortable operating in that manner. And there are at least six individuals that are ready to have petitions filed on their behalf. The district court also argues that this is a very narrow issue, and
go ahead and finish your thought, please.
And while it is narrow, it still does affect at least six other individuals, and it does affect other areas of law. This language is repeated throughout the NDOC and parole board statutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, thank all three of you for your excellent arguments and briefs in this case. And Ms. Brady, again to you, we always like to see our former law clerks come back and visit us once in a while in arguments. So we welcome the three of you to come anytime. We enjoy your arguments as well. So court will be in recess till 2:30.